It's Saturday, December 16th, 2005, and you're listening to the Typical PC User Podcast. All right, folks, we're very lucky tonight to have David Malin join us on Skype. We're going to see if we get a decent Skype connection. And I know that you know about David, not only because of my podcast, but more than likely because of the wonderful podcast that he is putting on with Harvard University. And it is a part of their extensions program, right, David?
That's right.
And so what we're doing tonight is when I saw the Harvard University programs, I encouraged you right away, I think it was show two or something, go out there, follow along, because the content that David and Harvard was providing for their students is so much in alignment with what I'm trying to do for my show. So I encourage you to go get all the shows. And if you had questions, I didn't know I was going to be this lucky to have David join me. So I asked you to come to me to ask the questions. But David, you were great enough to contact me and say, hey, why don't we do these questions together? So that's what we're going to do here tonight, folks. And I'm going to start off by asking a couple of questions of myself, of you, and just in general, David. And then from there, we can get into some of the questions that came via the audience. How does that sound?
That sounds terrific. I'm looking forward to it.
Great. Well, before we get going, why don't you just give us a little bit about the program at Harvard itself, where those who have not listened to your podcast can find you, so that we have that information out of the way right up front.
Sure. So I teach a course entitled Computer Science E1, Understanding Computers and the Internet, at Harvard University's Extension School. This is a survey course, essentially, on anything and everything related to IT. We start off the semester with a couple of lectures on computer hardware, move on to software, the internet, multimedia, security, website development, programming, pretty much a little bit of everything for everyone. The demographic of the course is that we have had 16-year-olds in high school who are simply taking the course by night to 70-something-year-olds who are taking the course in the words of one gentleman so as no longer to embarrass his grandchildren when it came to his computer savvy. So we get all types, and it's a fun course because the sort of course where everyone wants to be there and everyone's eyes end up lighting up at some point in the course because something finally clicks for them and they finally understand some tidbit that had once been escaping them.
So you came to podcasting, and was that obviously a conscious decision, because you're podcasting as well as video casting all of the classes, or just about all of them? Tell me a little bit about how you came to that decision and how supportive Harvard was of you actually using that medium to reach a much more vast audience than just in what's in the classroom.
Sure. Well, it was a decision that I came to late in the summer after I myself had become rather enamored with books on tape and listening to music and so forth while commuting, while walking to work, while on the subway and so forth. And it occurred to me that this was just yet another simple yet wonderful means of letting our students access the course in yet another venue. The course has been part of the Extension School's distance education program for the past several years, which means that students have long been able to take this course officially via the internet using high-resolution real videos that are synchronized with the slides and other materials that we use during a typical lecture. The downside, if any, of course, to that is that even though students could watch the lectures and absorb the material pretty much at their leisure, whether it was on the weekend or after they came home from work at the end of the day, they were still nonetheless tethered to their computer. And so what I think we've done with the podcast, among other things, is free students to take the material with them and really access it at their convenience, at their leisure. And also, I think it's been a wonderful mechanism by which students who are attending the lectures locally or who are sitting in front of their computers on at night watching the videos, they can at least use the audio tracks, or now the video tracks, to review that material, particularly before exams.
Yeah, the wonders of RSS. I mean, it's amazing. You've been consistently in the top 100 of the iPod podcasts. Obviously, the audience that you're reaching is much, much wider than probably you even imagined yourself. And I think you've really captivated a lot of people's educational need in this area. And I want to thank you for that, because that's exactly what typical PC users need.
No, I imagine as much. I appreciate that. It has certainly been a pleasant surprise. Again, we initially debuted the course on this podcast for our own students, and particularly looking ahead to our multimedia lecture, which was now just a couple of weeks ago, in which we often have talked about video and audio broadcasting and streaming video and so forth. And yet it was our goal this semester to, or for me at least, to hold up a little handheld device of me talking about a handheld device. And it actually worked pretty well. And I think students got a kick out of the fact that we were using the very technologies we were talking about in the course.
So let's get to some questions that the listeners had around some of the things that they obviously saw or listened to as they were watching the podcast. And I'm going to let you do most of the talking because that's why you're here. So we're going to start out with Kim. This is a male version of Kim. And he is actually, he didn't give me a city. He sent an audio question that I'll be playing right here, David.
Hey, Victor, this is Kim. I just wanted to call and say thanks for your show. And thanks for giving us an opportunity to ask questions for the Harvard E1 computer course. One of the first questions I had, and it may seem kind of basic, but I am new to this, is how does a solid state memory work, like the iPod Nano or MP3 player, where it remembers the data after the power has been turned off? It seems like computers are going to start utilizing this memory more and more often, and I'd like to have a better understanding of what it does. Secondly is, what is the difference between that and a calculator where the data is lost when it's turned off? If you could answer these questions, that'd be great. And if you do have time, I have another question. I know you'll probably have a lot of questions, but if you have time to squeeze this in, is if they could give a brief description of how a CPU works and how it knows the solution, or I guess the information that it does know based on just being a chip. I know that seems like a really basic question, but something that I've always wondered. So if you have time, that'd be great. Again, thank you very much. I love your show.
Okay. Well, first part first, then, how does solid state flash memory work on something like the Nano? It is essentially an electronic device that, unlike most other electronic devices, does not need a consistent flow of electricity in order to maintain state, as they say. So first of all computer data at the end of the day is stored in binary or in zeros and ones. And in the world of hard drives or floppy disks, this is done by way of magnetic particles being aligned in a particular way. And for those of you that have tuned into E1's podcast, you may recall our starting off the course with the so-called Woolly Willy, which was that childhood toy in which you put facial hair and so forth on a little photo of a man using a little magnet, and a magnetic particles aligned under that. So solid state memory is similar in spirit in that you're still storing the same kind of data at the end of the day, zeros and ones, but it achieves it in a very different fashion. Specifically, you have, talking about it on a somewhat high level, transistors and gates, as they're called, inside of flash memory. And what that means is that when you supply a stream of electricity to flash memory, what happens is you're able to trap those electrons in these things called gates. And once you have trapped a sufficient number of these electrons behind these gates, you've effectively stored the values zero, zero implying a sort of negative charge beneath these gates. If, however, you quote-unquote flash that memory subsequently, which you can do with a variety of software programs and hardware like digital cameras, you can flash the memory and essentially erase it, which means to release that electrical charge, making it back, resetting the device to its default, which is typically a one. So it's tough to give a more detailed description of how something like flash memory works. It's only audially, but what I can recommend if you are a more visual learner is to hop on Google or take a look specifically at a site called howstuffworks.com or wikipedia.com and search for flash memory. And I think one or both of those sites has a really nice tutorial or pictorials on the subject, which will put a bit more technical detail behind what I just said.
Absolutely. And what I'll do is, of course, I'll add those links right to the show notes so that when you go to the show notes for this show, it'll get you right to that. And my listeners are pretty familiar with Wikipedia because I am forever taking them there. So that's great.
Oh, good.
I think you also answered his second part of his question, which is, as you recall, he wanted to know what the difference was between that and a calculator that basically the data is lost.
Right. A calculator would typically use a different type of memory altogether, something more like a RAM, a random access memory, which, as in a typical PC, is a type of volatile memory, which means once you pull the plug or hit the power button, the electricity flowing through the device ceases. And because the RAM is constructed in a different way than flash memory is, it's simply not designed to retain those electrons. So the data is gone.
Right. And Kim's second question, and Kim, when we heard him there, he was kind of embarrassed that it's so basic, but I think it, you definitely covered it in your session one, is a brief description of how a CPU works and how it knows the information when it's just a chip. You know, how does it turn those zeros and those ones into something that we can see, hear, read, that kind of a thing. And I think that's a fair question from a beginner user.
Oh, absolutely. And I would not even say that it's a beginner question, because it is a it requires a remarkable leap of faith to go from an understanding of how a CPU works to a belief that it can actually perform the tasks that we're familiar with, like email checking and word processing and so forth. The short of it, as we discussed in some detail in Yuan's lectures 1 and 2, and somewhat later when we talked about programming more recently, is that a CPU is all about mathematics, and hardwired into a typical CPU is the ability to perform such basic operations as addition and subtraction and multiplication, and then some more interesting instructions like branching and testing for equality if two values are the same, or testing if some value equals zero, or testing if some value equals a constant. Well, many layers on top of that simplicity have been built over the years, a variety of programming languages and technologies that allow you to take these very simple building blocks and translate them into the much more complex operations of today's computers. You can appreciate this, I think, on a very real level and straightforward level if you consider quite simply the situation of booting up a typical PC. Most PCs, when you turn them on, you get a fairly black background and then some very basic text. Well, that, long story short, is the result of your BIOS having kicked in, which is the basic input-output system, which is essentially like a mini operating system that loads in hardware before something like Windows or Linux takes over. Well, that BIOS is capable, similarly, of very simple operations, like displaying text and displaying numbers on the screen. And essentially, by executing the very simple pieces of functionality that the CPU supports, it can display those most primitive operations of text display and numeric display. In fairness, I think, and again, I can't emphasize enough that it's by no means a newbie question how a CPU works. It really takes a good semester, I think, or a good bit of reading on the subject to then believe that from very simple additions and subtractions, you can build something like, for instance, AOL Instant Messenger. But at the end of the day, it does boil down to mathematics.
That's it. I was telling my son that the other day, you know, if you don't believe in math, then don't turn on your computer anymore, because it won't work.
Fortunately, it's very simple math. No calculus underneath the hood.
Yeah, he says, it's just zeros and ones, Dad, you know. All right, well, this next question slash comment comes from one of my listeners in Canada, Claire, who's really faithful and always listening to things and even contributes to the show. So she makes a statement first. She says, first, I want to say thank you for making these lectures available. I'm just loving the series. In the last year, we have seen podcasting and now video casting blossom into a new exciting phenomenon, which allows us to choose what, when, and where we experience the media that we want. The subscription-based downloadable content model allows us to access a whole new world of niche content providers. With this in mind, how do you think that the internet will develop in the next 5 years? What adjustments do you think that mainstream media will make to deal with a more demanding consumer base if they find they are losing advertising dollars to downloadable media? How will this concept of media converge be affected? That's a huge statement and a lot of complexity in there, but boy, I'm sure interested in hearing your opinion and your answer to this as well.
Sure. Well, first, thank you, Claire, for your comments and your very loaded question. These are the questions we often get in class, and I have the misfortune of being recorded for the past few years every time I make predictions, which usually come back to haunt me 5 years later. But what I can say in response to your first question, which was quite simply, how do you think the internet will develop in the next 5 years? I think we'll continue to see what on the surface is a very gradual transition. I think as bandwidth speeds increase to the home and to offices and already to universities, you've seen new applications becoming possible. Most recently, I think voice over IP, which has long been possible, but only now that most everyone and their friends has some kind of broadband connection, is it feasible simply to dial someone up like Victor, you and I have tonight, with remarkable quality and better than anything at absolute zero cost, at least for the use of that kind of application. So what I think you'll see is a greater prevalence, certainly, of some of the technologies that we're just beginning now to see catch on.
I agree.
And I wouldn't be surprised if there is even more of an attachment societally to multimedia distribution over the internet. I think it's become clear that people are enamored with the delivery of audio and soon even video via the internet. We're seeing delivery of video, for instance, not only on the internet, which is still rather pushing the envelope in terms of bandwidth capabilities, but that's a problem that will absolutely go away in the next couple of years. And we'll soon see, I think, people downloading entire movies legally over the internet. But in effect, you're seeing that already with local cable providers providing on-demand entertainment, which at the end of the day are simply computers sitting in your entertainment center downloading this content using technologies very similar to what your PCs are actually using. I think the question regarding what adjustments the mainstream media have to make in the industry at large is a wonderful question. And I think very few of the big players have handled the situation well so far. I think the fact that iTunes was one of the largest suppliers of music, digital or non-digital, over the past year or so is a testament to people's genuine and legal interest in downloading things like audio files over the internet, and an indication certainly that to some extent people are willing to pay for that. And I do think that it's going to be the industry players that embrace what I do believe is inevitable, the delivery and the demand for digital multimedia distribution via the internet and similar technological means, that ultimately I think are going to fare well. I think the companies that are fighting this trend and are, for instance, polluting peer-to-peer networks with bogus files, and who are spending most of their resources currently on lawsuits, and companies that are, for instance, embedding the so-called rootkits inside of the CDs that they're shipping, I think are fighting a trend that's inevitable. And I think what it suggests on their part is either a failure to really grasp the inevitable, or perhaps a mentality that's resistant to change. And that's not to say that what they are condemning, the illegal download of music and so forth, is fundamentally bad. But I haven't seen in lockstep with that some innovative embracings of the technology. And I think very few, perhaps Apple with iTunes and a couple of other companies aside, I don't think we've really seen some particularly interesting things happening in the space until actually TiVo, for instance, and Apple and some of the TV networks now that have proposed for some number of cents or dollars you can download entire episodes of various TV shows to the iPod. I think that's a brilliant step in a logical direction. And I think it's those players who take that step are going to find that there is money to be made even in those kinds of new markets and new technologies.
Yeah, and I think to add to that, and I think iTunes with their model right now, video downloads, they have in a very short amount of time sold a tremendous amount of downloads. I think 2 or 3 million is the number I've been hearing in the last week. And I think what's going to happen is multimedia companies, conglomerates like you mentioned, Claire, the ones that are quick and nimble and quick to market are the ones that are going to end up being the winners. We saw that just recently here, and that ABC started with iTunes, but right away now NBC has jumped in with both feet and are providing catalogs of TV shows that have set in shelves for years, the old Dragnet series, that all of a sudden have market value. So if they start looking at the world from a different point of view and they act in the good of the market, it will balance out those other forces, David, that you spoke about, I think.
No, I do think so. And I think though this digital revolution where you have such low cost means of distribution is certainly distinct from years past when, for instance, the introduction of VHS and Betamax were the threat, and subsequently DVDs, at least with respect to a threat against the movie theater industry. And just as some of the companies back then were worried that, wow, if you put this kind of media in the hands of people via rental stores, no one's going to go to the theaters anymore. I don't think that has actually panned out. And I think that there will always be money to be made, I think, off of content and off of media. And I think the company simply needs to find those ways to do so and to ultimately embrace them rather than bucking these technological trends.
Yeah, I agree. Claire, that's a great question and comment. Actually, David and I could probably come back every 6 months and answer that question again. It'd be interesting to see what that trend looks like if we took every recording and compared it, I think.
But particularly 5 years from now to see how on target we were.
Yeah, 5 years from now, I don't know how we would be doing that conference, but it'd be interesting, that's for sure. Well, we're going to turn now to Mark from Wisconsin, another real faithful listener. And he has a couple of questions also having to do, well, real good for the holidays, I think. The first one is, hey, David, what kind of computer would you recommend to a first-time computer buyer today who has a limited knowledge of computers and software?
It's an excellent question, and also a loaded question since it's among the more common ones from our own students. I would say, first of all, that if you have limited knowledge of computers and software, I do think to this day that Apple has done a better job than, say, Microsoft in making computers easy to use. And for years, I grew up on Macs, and one of my first computers when I was a child was a Macintosh, and it was only later in college that I segued to PCs. But I've used both, and I have no particular passion for either of them. I simply use what is appropriate to the kind of work that I do and what is most convenient at the time. But I have no qualms, even though I use mostly PCs myself, at suggesting to someone that they pursue a Macintosh as their first, it sounds, computer. With that said, I think to this day you will pay a bit more for Macintosh hardware than you will for comparable PC hardware. If one is already familiar with Macs or PCs, I think they should simply, if they're a relative newbie, stick with the platform with which they're most comfortable. I don't think they'll find themselves at a disadvantage either way. If one goes the route of choosing a PC, I've always been a fan of Dell. I haven't bought their computers in some time since I've switched to Sony more recently, but I think Dell's level of service is remarkable, and they are wonderful if anything goes wrong at literally sending someone to your home or to your office to swap out that failing piece of hardware, which I think is a wonderful reassurance to someone who is otherwise not quite familiar with their own computers or how they work or how to fix them. IBM has for a while been quite popular, certainly among college campuses, because of their ThinkPad line of laptops. Now that they've sold off their computer division, I think people are a little unclear or uncertain as to whether the quality will remain. I've personally never been such a fan of the ThinkPad, since I find them less than aesthetically pleasing and rather years dated.
That's an understatement.
In style. And that's actually, frankly, why I switched to Sony. The past two laptops I've had have both been Sony Vaios, and it's purely for their sexiness and how sharp their laptops look, how small they are, and just how well they tend to work. So I would have no qualms at recommending that someone take a look at Sony as well.
Yeah, I definitely agree, and my listeners know that I am a user of both PCs, and I'm a recent switcher to Apple. And
to Apple.
Yes, we're doing that. We're doing this podcast on an iMac, but I am, like yourself, I am one that's neutral in that use the tool that is best to be used. Now, my reasons for switching, we can probably talk about in a little while. We talk about security a little bit, but I think that there's plenty of room. They are both PCs, contrary to popular belief. They're personal computers, and they both have a place in the space. So that's great. All right. Mark also asked about what you believe now the present state of broadband internet access is going to look like, and when is it going to become faster and more affordable?
I do, on both accounts. I think the speed is inevitable, and we're already seeing new technologies emerge that are already much faster than typical cable modems and DSL modems. College campuses have long had high-speed internet access, and now I think we're seeing that even more so in homes as well as in the office. I think the fact that you can sign up for DSL, at least in the northeast of the U.S., with Verizon, say, for $14.95 per month, at least initially, and then I think it maxes out at maybe $25 a month, $30 a month.
Same thing in the West.
Is it? Okay. Yeah, not amazingly cheap, certainly, when you figure in 12 months are in a year, but I think that's remarkably cheaper than, for instance, Comcast, which is a big player out here, who still charges between $45 and $55 a month for cable modem service. And as time passes, Verizon's DSL service is becoming more comparable in terms of speed. And frankly, I think it's at the point now where for a typical user, even though Verizon's DSL service maxes out essentially at 3 megabits, whereas Comcast now can get upwards of 5 and 8 megabits.
Right.
The typical user doesn't need 5 or 8 megabits, or arguably doesn't even need 3 megabits. And so I think, and as a personal user myself, I'm hoping Comcast's own prices come down in the future. I think you see in Europe already, friends of mine have told me the kinds of prices they pay for the bandwidth they have. And a friend of mine in Sweden, for instance, is getting 2 or 3 times the 2 or 4 megabits that I get on my own connection and is paying less per month.
Now, talk about that a little bit. That's very interesting, because this audience is not just an American audience, and I've had listeners from Germany call in and talk to me about just that subject. They say, why are you Americans so far behind in this area?
Well, and there are different pricing models, too. A friend of mine who lives in Vienna, Austria, they actually have a plan, which is not uncommon there, whereby they pay for the megabyte, which we have never really seen in recent years in the U.S. when it comes to at least to broadband access. So I think you're seeing, in short, new pricing models emerge. I think you're seeing lower pricing altogether for a lot of these technologies. And I think that so long as there is competition in this industry between DSL and cable modem and whatever comes next, I do think the prices will continue to go down. I think the bandwidth will continue to go up. But I do think we're already reaching a point where the bandwidth for today's applications is more than sufficient. So what I think is exciting to watch is that as the bandwidth pipes increase, exactly what new and novel applications are going to come out that we haven't even thought of today.
Yeah, that's for sure. And it was funny, as I read this question, I thought to myself, by the time I'm finished asking the question, the broadband speed would be faster and cheaper. That's how fast this industry is moving. You just mentioned something that's a perfect lead-in to the next set of questions that come from Trucker Tom. And if you don't know who Trucker Tom is, he's a very popular podcaster who goes around the U.S. in his truck podcasting to all of us. And he has a very entertaining show in that you just get to listen to him talk about just about anything. And he used to be in the IT world. So if you haven't checked out Trucker Tom, make sure you do that. But Trucker Tom asked this question.
Hey, Victor and David. This is Tom Wiles from West Fork, Arkansas, a.k.a. Trucker Tom. I've got a couple of questions for David. The first is, where does he see computer storage going within the next 5 years? And I'm primarily more concerned about with the home computer as opposed to just the science in general. I'm just wondering, practically, where is it going? Today, I've got an 80-gigabyte hard drive in my laptop. What is that going to be 5 years from now? The other question that I had, what sort of implications does he see for the day that's coming very soon, I think, that your car may have an IP address or your refrigerator may have an IP address? What kind of implications does that lead to? And I think that it leads to things that we haven't even thought of yet, but there's going to be some amazing things, but does he have any idea what those amazing things might be? So, anyway, thanks for the show and the opportunity to ask the questions, and I'll be listening.
So it, too, is a good question. A little tougher, I think, to predict than some of the other trends, but I will say that, one, we've seen remarkable decreases over the past few years in the cost of storage, particularly for mass storage like hard drives. You can go to Best Buy or Circuit City on a typical weekend these days when they're having sales and buy 120 gigabyte, even 200 gigabyte hard drives for, say, $30 after rebates. Mm-hmm. A lot of these incredibly low prices are the result of rebates, but the fact of the matter is we're beginning to pay now tens of cents or pennies, really, for the amount of storage space that we're getting per megabyte. However, with that said, I do think, and I am fairly comfortable predicting, that what we'll see over the next few years is a much greater use of solid state memory, coming back to our discussion of flash memory earlier tonight, where you will have, I think, devices that do have larger capacities for storage but are using non-mechanical devices. I think that's long been a weakness of the PC design fundamentally, is that of the many different components in a PC, for the most part, the only moving one besides the optical drives and the floppy drive have been the hard drives. And ignoring, for instance, the fans, which are simply there to keep things cool, it's the hard drives that have tended to contribute to the noise levels of computers. It's the hard drives that more often than not are what have failed if something breaks in a computer or you have trouble recovering your data, because components that don't move are less likely to break on average than those that do, for simple reasons of degradation and wear. And I do think now, as price simming down and we're seeing demand for flash memory increase in the Nano and other devices, that its price too and its storage capacity too or some variant of the technology will increase.
And I think that that's going to be an evolutionary step in that they're first going to start with flash memory at the random access level before they actually, as it increases in capacity, then actually be able to go into longer storage memory, if you will. I think that's the path it'll take. How do you think that's going to evolve?
I think so too, but I think the speed with which this technology has advanced has been remarkable. For instance, the Nano, I think, is currently available in 4 or 6 gigabyte flavors. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Two and four.
So we're talking a 4 gigabyte drive in a device the size of a few of one's fingers. And this is in contrast with, for instance, the laptops and PCs of just a few years ago, which came with, by default, hard drives that were only 320 megabytes and then later maybe 1 gigabyte. And I think quite rapidly, for instance, we've seen from Apple's devices alone, us go from the iPod Shuffle with its 512 or 1 gigabyte memory to 4 times that. And I think it will be interesting to see, not even 5 years out, but a year or two out, just exactly how big these the storage capacities of this technology becomes.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that flash-based startup, which would, you know, take literally seconds now. You know, it should be very, very fast if you can use flash memory to actually boot an OS. So,
oh, absolutely.
That's going to be pretty sweet. And I think, again, it's MIT who's building the $100 laptop, flash-based. Mm-hmm. That's completely flash-based. So. I think it's definitely going to go there, but we seem to keep on getting hungrier and hungrier for storage, where now it is not uncommon to see a 300 gigabyte hard drive come in a $600 computer. It seems like the more media that we are serving up, the bigger and bigger these hard drives are going to get. So can we actually catch up with this flash race to traditional media storage that requires such large volumes?
It's an excellent question, and I am actually surprised that the demand for this kind of technology, IDE hard drives and now serial ATA hard drives, has persisted as long as it has. And I was struck by the fact that I was in a Best Buy this past weekend just looking around, and on the shelves were just dozens of different hard drives, different sizes, different manufacturers, clearly being sold to the typical PC user, no pun intended. And yet it is so remarkably difficult for a typical user to add or upgrade a hard drive in their computer to this day, with the whole notion of primary and secondary channels and master and slave devices. It's just amazing that the technology has become as accessible or as much in demand as it is. And I contrast this just in my own mind with the notion of now we're seeing more USB drives, which, though they might underneath it all be IDE or serial ATA based, but albeit with a USB or FireWire cable, finally storage is becoming easier and as simple as just plugging it into a slot on your computer. And I think flash memory will facilitate that all the more, whereby when you want to insert, for instance, your disk containing last year's worth of family photos, it's as simple as sliding in the flashed kind of device into the front of your computer, and no more tinkering with the actual insides of things and cables and jumpers and so forth.
Yeah, I think that's going to make things a little easier. Tom also asked what the implications are when it becomes possible for our cars and our refrigerators and other devices such as these to have an IP address.
Sure. That's a fun question. And Scott McNeely, for instance, at Sun Microsystems, has long been a proponent of the network PC, and others have proposed similar ideas where you're putting your toaster on your own network. I mean, Java, rather tongue-in-cheek years ago, was touted as a platform-independent language that would be quite well-suited for such devices as one's toaster and so forth in the kitchen, simply because it could then speak on a network to other devices in some open standard. Well, I think now, 2005, we haven't really seen ourselves plugging in many of our appliances, not only into the electrical outlets of our homes, but also to network jacks. And I think that's to some extent because most of the applications or most of the ideas surrounding this technology simply aren't compelling, or at least the infrastructure is not yet in place that would make the features compelling. For instance, one that I've discussed at length with many people over the years is the idea of your refrigerator, for instance, being able to reorder products for you. So mm-hmm. you have your refrigerator plugged into the network. Maybe you have some kind of barcode scanner built into the refrigerator that you would then manually scan items over when you're about to throw them out for being empty or put them in for being fresh. Or perhaps in the nearer future, having things like RFID tags simply be embedded in the products that we purchase so that the refrigerator can simply figure out what is in there for you. And then as quantities get low or products disappear, it phones home, quote unquote, to the nearest peapod.com or the equivalent wherever you are, and someone shows up in a truck to redeliver those products. I think if you can make processes like that simple and user-friendly and entirely dummy-proof, then they will be used. And I think people would say, absolutely, sure, I'll take that feature. But I don't think we have that kind of infrastructure in place. And I think that some people do go too far by proposing that things like our toasters need to be on our network, where it's hard to imagine queries that would be interesting to ask your toaster. But by contrast, one of the applications I would love to have in my own home would be network-based control of my own thermostat, so that I no longer have to tinker every morning with predictions as to what time I'm going to come home and therefore what time I would like the heat to come on. I would, in an ideal world, like to be able to punch a few buttons into my cell phone or similar device that say, David's home should now have the heat turned up to this particular level. And there certainly do exist technologies that facilitate this, X10 and so forth, but they are all way too expensive and way too complicated, certainly for the typical user, to lower the barrier sufficiently whereby people start picking up this kind of technology.
Yeah.
But I think we'll get there once it is more omnipresent.
Yeah, I think so too. And I think when we talk about RFID and those types of things, I think once, if the people who are marketing those things can get past some of the social implications and some of the paranoid people that are going to sit there and say, hey, if you know how much I consume milk and at what rate, then you know too much about me, and that's you're violating my privacy. We're going to have to get through some of that, and that's just going to be some social conditioning, I think, that will have to happen when we just get over it. You need to trust somebody sometime, type of thing.
No, absolutely. I think that's a wonderful objection, a really concern, too, that I didn't even think to mention there. And I will say, to tie this into our discussion earlier about bandwidths, I do think that as network speeds and technologies improve, I think a lot of even these applications will become more feasible. For instance, I have a Verizon wireless phone, and though I like the quality of voice service, the latency on the data traffic that most cell phones are capable of today in this country, the latency is just way too high. It would take me probably 30 to 60 seconds to even patch into something like my home, even were it on the network. And the fact of the matter is, that's too slow. I need to be able to flip my phone or similar device open, push a button, close it, and be done. And the network infrastructure that is largely in place to this day, or at least the price that one charges for anything better, simply doesn't allow for, I think, clever uses of technology like that.
Yeah, Tom, I think for now we're going to have to settle for the USB aquarium and leave it at that.
I've seen these things.
All right, the next question comes from Alex from here in California. And actually, David, you hadn't seen this one, so if we need to edit or whatever, no problem. He sent it to me late here. He said, well, it's going to be a no-brainer for you. One question I have is, what is really the difference between the old PCI slot and the new PCI Express slot? And with a lot of the new graphics cards, such as the NVIDIA 7800 series, using PCI Express, will the old AGP slot go away?
Okay, so that too is a very specific question. The short of it is that I would describe PCI Express as basically a newer, better incarnation of PCI, which, as I recall, does improve upon the speed, the throughput
speed,
rate.
Right? Yeah, throughput, right.
Yeah, absolutely offered of PCI, and I believe it's also backwards compatible. What I think you're seeing, though, today is that much of the hardware that a typical user would demand is being integrated anyway into the motherboard, for instance. And even in my course, we don't emphasize so much even the role of PCI and ISA cards and AGP cards in computers, because for the most part, computers are fortunately getting to the point where most people don't have to open them and actually add hardware to them, and a lot of these kinds of slots are going unused. With that said, to compare PCI with AGP, I'm simply not familiar enough with the two technologies to have an intelligent opinion on which might be better, or whether one will AGP will remain or PCI Express will become more useful. But I do think in general that the release of new iterations of this kind of hardware is certainly inevitable, and what it offers to a typical user is just faster speeds usually.
Yeah. Alex, what I'll do, of course, is put up a Wikipedia, because I know that in the wiki there are articles about both PCI Express and PCI, and it talks about the differences. I think what we're talking about, like you said, David, for the typical user here, the built-in graphics card and the motherboards are fine. When we start talking about things like NVIDIA 7800s, we're talking about some of the faster demanding games here, or some of the video or photographic type applications that require this type of hardware. And I have somewhat mixed feelings, because we start getting into an issue of bottleneck. It's like, what do you want your bottleneck in your computer to be? Your graphics card, your memory, your hard drive. So you start almost fighting this battle of hardware, whereas your game, a $50 game now, requires a $700 card to run correctly. And that equation to me starts not being so equal, as far as in my humble opinion.
Yes, no, I agree. And I do think that I'm surprised that we've lingered for so many years as we have with the architecture of a PC that exists today. And I think what you see, for instance, in the Mac, that for better or for worse, they're not as easily opened.
Yes, that's right.
But I think that's indicative of the fact that most users, and certainly not all, myself, I probably prefer things that I can manipulate more easily than some of the newer computers today. But I think it's an archaic system, PCI, AGP, and ISA cards in the first place, whereby you have to open the case of your computer, move some wires around, unscrew something, push a card in, cross your fingers that Windows or OS is going to detect it, install driver. It's just the fact that it takes me that many breaths to explain the technology, I think should do it in ultimately. Things need to be easier to use, and I think we're getting there.
Thank you so much. I totally agree with you. All right, we're going to turn up the ratchet a little bit here, and I'm going to tap into something else here that you, one of my favorite segment probably in your entire series, and that had to do with security and, of course, with you being a part-time forensic analyst for, is a prosecutor, right?
Indeed, that's correct.
And so that's a fascinating subject to me, just my own geek self. So I thought it would be a good time to bring that up and maybe to have you have you tell us a little bit about what you don't know lies in your hard drive today, and what we as consumers need to do to make sure that as we dispose of our computers, whether we're giving them to our relatives or we're donating them to organizations. You mentioned in the series on security some tools, and I think people just don't realize the kind of things that are left behind when one thinks that they have a clean hard drive.
Sure. Well, the short of it is that most of their data, if they bequeath a computer to someone else or sell it or donate it, most of their data does remain on that computer when they give it away. And this is even if the users are, for instance, thoughtful enough to format the hard drive or to highlight everything, for instance, and then drag it to the recycle bin and even empty the recycle bin and then donate or bequeath the computer to someone else, because neither of those operations, deletion in the typical sense or formatting, actually delete most of the data on the drive. As we discussed in our security lectures and even back in our hardware lectures, the data is simply forgotten about, but the zeros and ones that comprise the files and the documents and the folders that you intended to delete ultimately remain on the disk. And only once you continue using your computer and creating new files, downloading additional files that would effectively and probabilistically overwrite the space previously occupied by those deleted files, are you really starting to get rid of the data. And so what I recommended to our students this year is that if they wish to dispose of a computer, they certainly should just not leave it out for anyone to take. If they want to give a computer to someone, if they want to donate a computer to someone, I would either hang on to the hard drive and dispose of it independent of the computer in a place that it's not going to be used or examined by someone else if they worry there's sensitive data on it. Or better yet, I would certainly wipe the drive before even getting rid of the computer, assuming it's still operational. And there's one utility which is nice because it's free and works rather well, called Derek's Bootenuke, aka DBAN, which is a little Linux-based utility, essentially a Linux-based utility that, or like a DOS-based utility for those more familiar, that you copy onto a floppy disk, you boot your computer when you're ready to get rid of everything truly and forever. You boot the computer with this floppy, it runs for several hours and quote-unquote wipes the hard drive, which essentially means it overwrites it with a whole bunch of random data and eventually all zeros, so that your data probabilistically and with high probability is truly gone, even to the most determined adversary. Barring that, physical destruction of hard drives is perhaps the next most surefire and truly most surefire way of destroying data. And to do that, fire, mechanical destruction of the devices, drilling holes through the platters are perhaps the most surefire ways of doing things.
Absolutely. And if nothing else, folks, that you get out of today's program here is make sure you go and listen to the security part. Because, David, you made some wonderful point about people being afraid of the wrong things and that they need to be afraid of the right things. If you're going to be afraid of something, you know, don't be afraid of the credit card number out there. Be afraid of something that really can come back to haunt you, like leaving these data bits behind as you bequeath your computer to someone. And the utility that you spoke about is free. You can go out and spend a lot of money on disk wipe utilities. You don't need to. And that's part of the point here. So do that. Use a disk wipe utility. Make sure that you listen to the security program. As you said, you'll be sufficiently scared to take action. And I think that was a good way that you put it there. And then lastly, I think you being in the criminal forensic business, you know probably better than most that people who are out there doing the wrong things that do not, they will leave back evidence. There is trace evidence almost always.
That's quite true.
Great. So that's going to take us into our last set of questions for the evening, which come from George Starcher. And my audience knows George as one of the hosts from the In the Trenches podcast. What is your opinion of the ability of software write blockers for forensics that will stand up in court as compared to hardware-based blockers?
So that's a good question, and I can speak only anecdotally what I have heard over time is that it tends to be easier to convince someone of the correctness of a piece of hardware. The irony, of course, and what's obvious to anyone sufficiently technically savvy, is that at the end of the day, even these hardware devices are usually hardware devices with firmware, and it's the firmware that's actually implementing the write block, or sometimes it is actually written into the device, but just as you can err when writing software, so can you certainly err when wiring a device. And I've also heard anecdotally that a number of the write-blocking products on the market have occasionally been circumvented accidentally by the forensic analysts who are using the hardware, which is to say that, again, only anecdotally, that even some of the hardware-based devices have manifested errors. I think from an intellectual standpoint and from a technical standpoint, it's irrelevant whether you use a hardware-based blocker or a software-based blocker. What's more important is that, one, it's correct, or really that you trust what it's doing. With that said, software-based blocking is probably cheaper on the whole since it can be more easily updated and there are fewer barriers to procuring it. A lot of the hardware-based blockers today are ridiculously expensive despite their conceptual simplicity and what they set out to do.
The second question is a little bit more specific, and George is talking about here, do you know of any tools for forensics that work to defeat an IDE hard drive password? Now, folks, I'm talking about a password here that is at the BIOS level of a hard drive so that you can put that password in and, in essence, block entrance to that password. So he said, I found one utility sold by a company in the UK, but that's about all. So George is asking if, as a forensic analyst, you know of other tools that might be able to defeat these type of IDE hard drive passwords.
I wish I had a specific suggestion for you, but I do not. I can only say from a technical standpoint that it should absolutely be possible to implement such software, but I've not had the need to make use of it as of yet, so I'm not familiar with any that exist.
Hacking is a two-sided coin, and so for every potential danger or mal that someone should come out there and invent, it is the job of security and forensic analysts to be able to find out how to defeat those things for the good of the many. So when George asks a question like this, you can be sure that it's for reasons that would serve the law correctly. So George, thanks for those questions. So David, what I'm going to close here with is a question from my wife, right? I mean, I have to pay the bill somehow, you know? And,
okay.
And early on in my show, I think show number two, I did an interview with her because she absolutely is a typical PC user.
Okay.
And she said, you know, Victor, when are they just going to make a computer that I can just use? I don't have to take a class to use my toaster. I don't have to understand how the inner workings of my radio are when I turn it on. Why is it that if I own a computer, I have to know all of these things about it. I have to know how to keep it clean. I have to know how to go inside and take out bad stuff. As a user, she said, this is what frustrates me away from using computers. So I thought that that would be an appropriate statement. And then question to you is, what do you say to those type of users that are saying, you know, you just haven't made all this simple enough yet for me to be attracted to using computers?
I think that's a fair reason to shy away from using them, though I think it's becoming increasingly hard today to avoid using computers, even if it's simply to keep in touch with people via email or to look up information via the web. I think your wife's concern is hugely on target, and I wholeheartedly agree with the fact that computers to this day, even the Apple Macintosh, is far too complicated than it should be for what it needs to do. And personally, I am much more of a fan, and I would hope, though I worry that we never will get to a point where we have models more like the managed computers that we really started out with in this industry of having dumb terminals, where you might have a terminal screen in your office or in your kitchen where you throw a switch. There's no need to boot up any software to load anything into memory because the images being displayed are, for instance, coming to you from some central managed system, maybe a service provider that you pay a monthly fee for, and that service provider might provide you with very big, simple icons on the main menu, one for typing email, one for maybe surfing the web or the equivalent, another for composing a document. And yet, the fact of the matter is, those three applications, email, the web, and word processing, could probably satisfy a whole lot of typical PC users out there today, even if you didn't have the bells and whistles of other programs like instant messaging and FTP and a whole suite of other types of software. I think the whole industry, perhaps out of necessity, but still just as tragically, started out on this trend where the computers were not designed with the user in
hardware, although
still to this day, seeing Mac OS and in Windows, cryptic error messages written by programmers who either didn't care to write human comprehensible messages, or for whom those messages were largely for themselves rather than typical users. Absolutely. And I think Windows XP has made a step towards simplifying things in a good direction. I think Mac OS has long done this, but arguably I think Mac OS has gotten a little more complicated than it once was. And granted, a lot of the underlying Unix derivations are hidden from the user, but there's increasing complexity there. And I think a lot of this complexity these days stems from companies' need to increase revenue and come out with new versions of software and implement features that people aren't necessarily demanding, or even if they are, it's a subset of users. But the end result is that even if 10% of your users want this feature, you put it in, that means now that only 90% of your software makes sense to me, the more typical user. And I think Microsoft for years has announced that a typical user uses maybe 10%, if that, of say any of their products like Microsoft Word or PowerPoint's features. But they exist because for each user, it's a different 10% of features. And that's great for them that I think that they're appealing to a broad user base by having all of these applications. But even I am overwhelmed by a lot of the software out there today because you have innumerable menus and submenus and so forth. And I think the fact that we have certification programs in this world for using forensic software and for using Office applications and database applications is ridiculous and is the wrong solution to the problem. You should not need to be trained on software. You should not need training on software. It should be much more intuitive than it is today.
And I think that a great example of that is, for example, where users like you and I are being driven towards the simpler applications like Gmail. We are users that could use any email client we wanted to use and we could conquer it. But we, a lot of my geek friends, we've all gravitated to Gmail. Why? It's, you know, web 2.0 based. It's simple in its core. It stores my data. It keeps it forever. And I can get in and get out from anywhere. And I think that this may be where the killer applications of the future are, that they perhaps go away from the physical box and transcend now into the ether, where the user can then decide at what level of complexity they want to play in the world of computing.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I think even AOL Instant Messenger today is far more complicated than it should be.
Yeah, it's like we make it harder just because we can.
Yeah.
Well, David, I really want to thank you. We've taken a good long time. This is going to be a great show, and I want to thank you and have you leave the audience with whatever message you want. I would hope that perhaps you can come back to the show. You obviously have an open door to do a segment anytime, and I would love to have you be a contributor to the show whenever you'd like.
Sure. Well, Victor, certainly, first and foremost, I appreciate having had the chance to chat with you and your listeners tonight. It's been a lot of fun. I would certainly suggest that the typical PCU are out there take a look at our podcast while we're still broadcasting this semester. We have just a couple lectures left in the semester. The easiest way to find us is probably on Google by searching for Harvard Podcast, but I'm sure there may be a link to it right on the webpage once this chat is posted. And certainly feel free to drop me an email after we go offline tonight with any questions you might have or certainly any interest in the programs offered.
So what's next for Harvard as far as podcasting? Can the audience count on having some other courses Harvard's going to provide to all of us out there via podcast?
It's a great question, and unfortunately, I don't yet have the answer since it is a matter for current debate. I think that it is absolutely under consideration for a course I teach in the spring and as well as for courses by some other instructors at the Extension School as well as at Harvard College. I think there are some natural concerns that a lot of the faculty and administration have, both academic and financial alike. And I think what we have found this semester, though, that it's been a wonderful mechanism of reaching out, certainly from the Extension School's perspective, to corners of the world with a technology that is reaching places that, say, the Extension School's printed catalog isn't. And I think the means of our accessing a broader potential student body have been wonderful, certainly for E1's, from E1's perspective. And I think what we've ultimately been then is an experiment for the Extension School and dare say for Harvard at large, as they look toward doing things like this and similar technologies over the next few semesters. So I am just as curious as you to see what the university in an official capacity decides to do over the next couple of years.
Well, that's great. And let me just speak from just a consumer out there, a person out there, that I haven't said the name Harvard as often as I have in the last few months. And to me, it spoke about Harvard's commitment to the community beyond its financial reach. And I'll put this in the show because I think it's worth Harvard listening to that kind of outreach beyond just your community is making an impact on how others view Harvard. And Harvard has shown by taking this step that all of us can do something like provide an extension program and get a Harvard education, if you will, in this case for free, but for very little cost when you compare it to the game that you're going to get back. So I think that's one way I can get back to Harvard and thank them for what they've done with your class.
Oh, well, absolutely. And I appreciate that. And I do think that there is not a more literal or technological way of truly extending the reach of a university in the extension school sense than by reaching out to people technologically with software like podcasts.
And we have been talking to Professor David Malam from Harvard University's Extension Program. David, thank you so much and look forward to having you back on the show.
Great. Thanks.
Thanks a lot. Good night. Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right, folks, that's it. I hope that you enjoyed listening to that show as much as I enjoyed bringing it to you. It's almost an hour-long show. That's pretty rare for me, but I hope you thought it was worth it. If you did, please go out to my site, www.typicalpcuser.com, and vote for me for Podcast Alley. You'll find a link right there on the site. It's very easy to do. If not, go directly to podcastalley.com and in the search field, put typical PC user. That will take you to the link and you can vote for me there. Also, while you're at it, vote for Trucker Tom Wiles. He's never asked anyone to vote for Podcast Alley before, and this month he is pimping it and I'm going to help him. So go out to Podcast Alley, vote for me, vote for Tom, but mostly thank you for being a part of my listening audience. Please come back next week and listen to me once again. If you're not subscribed, make sure you do that. For now, this is Victor Cahill, the typical PC user. For now, this is Victor Cahill, the typical PC user podcast, saying enjoy.